You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Yamashansan. I'm joined by my co-counsel, Lucas Wildhack, and Michael Holleran for the appellant, Natalie Pomar of Arlington, Virginia, who is also in attendance. We may, Your Honor, we reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
All right.
This case presents the question, is the substantial compliance doctrine relating to the statute of wills dead in Virginia? In this sense, it is
but
a case...
But it actually presents a threshold question, is even if you're right, was it filed outside of time?
Your Honor, if the substantial compliance doctrine exists in Virginia, then the time bar that exists in Section 404 has never applied to a strictly compliant or substantially compliant will. We have, in this case, a unique situation with Mr. Hash's will execution, because the case turns in preventing strict compliance with the statute, we have third parties' interference with the will signing. And this court has never previously adjudicated a substantial compliance case under Code Section 403 in which a third party, hot to hear a hospital staff member, obstructed a will subscription by a second witness, and in which the undisputed audio of the will's execution is in evidence to corroborate substantial compliance with the statute of wills. Thomas James Hash signed the will.
But the test is not almost substantial compliance or almost, if you let me stay there for another 5 minutes, actual compliance. The test is compliance. And then you have a one-year window to try to sneak in something else. Why? I know you think this is oversimplistic, but explain why that isn't.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the one-year statute that the court is citing, Justice Kelsey, is in Section 404.
Right.
And the trial court clearly held that Section 404 was the only procedural mode within which a litigant could pursue probating a non-strictly compliant will in Virginia.
Right, well, tell me why this is oversimplistic. 403 says you have to do it a certain way. It wasn't done that way. 404 says if you don't do it the certain way we told you in 403, and the law somehow lets you get it in anyway with some other sort of document or some non-compliant document, you got a year to do it. What's wrong with that logic?
The logic essentially accepts the trial court's statutory interpretation that the enactment of Section 404 displaced the common law substantial compliance doctrine under Section 403. You have to essentially accept that Section 404, when you look at 404, there's no plainly manifest language in Section 404 that says we're displacing 160 years of jurisprudence of this court that recognizes substantial compliance. When you look at 404...
Why is it displacing it? Why is it not just saying you have a year to make the argument? And if it fits a substantial compliance test, fine, but you've got a year to make that argument.
Well, Section 404, Your Honor, grants this additional remedy that Your Honor is referencing. And Section 404 opens the door to signed letters, cocktail napkins, internet wills. We're talking about a substantially compliant will that was intended to strictly comply. Thomas James Hash intended to strictly comply. And this court, in its substantial compliance jurisprudence, has never subjected a strictly compliant or a substantially compliant will to a one-year time bar.
Why doesn't 404, by necessary implication, supplant what you view as 100 years of substantial compliance, whether it's wildly out of compliance written on a napkin or whether it is the scrivener's name being considered as a witness signature? Why doesn't 404 cover all of that? And if your will does not strictly comply with 403, you have a year to bring it to probate. Why isn't that the analysis of this case?
Justice Powell, the analysis in this case really fits more in line with cases such as Justice Goodwin's opinion in Crucible, which we cited, which is that this court does not construe a statute as displacing a common law remedy unless it's expressly stated.
Or by necessary implication.
Yes, and if we look for textual context in the statute, we look at 404B, for example, and we see that 404B, the legislature said, the remedy granted by this section, if there were text in this section that said the exclusive remedy in this section, perhaps we could necessarily imply that this is what they intended to displace.
But a statute of limitation provision is not displacing common law. Under Justice Powell's question, the construct is 404 is permitting the common law substantial compliance theory to go forward. It's just putting a time limit on it. That's not a derogation of common law, is it?
It is inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence. This court has never applied a time bar to a strictly compliant or substantial compliance.
Until the General Assembly told us that we had to.
The General Assembly displaces our jurisprudence all the time. They're the policymakers.
Yes, Justice McCullough, but usually this court would say, if you're going to displace our jurisprudence, you have to be express. It has to be plainly manifest. It isn't plainly manifest.
Well, it might be, it might not be. Let me pose a hypothetical that will actually get to that.
Yes, Justice.
Hypothetical is this. Hypothetical is that 404 has no time bar. That there is no statute of limitations expressed in it. Okay? Now, if that is the case, under what circumstances would an attorney move forward under the substantial compliance doctrine rather than under 404?
I think that it would create a remedy that would moot the reason to pursue under 403, to pursue a claim under 403. But I don't believe that the addition of this remedy is exactly
404. So in other words, the statute has supplanted the common law to the extent that if you are within the one-year period, there is no reason why you would plead a common law complaint. You would only plead under the statute.
That's not necessarily true.
Okay, then tell me under what set of facts you would choose to plead. Your client would benefit from you pleading a common law complaint, common law cause of action, as opposed to a statutory cause of action.
Justice Vins, the common law cause of action has, and actions in Devizet Bell Non generally, are subject to a preponderance of the evidence standard, greater weight of the evidence standard. The code section that we have before us, 404, codifies a clear and convincing evidence test. It does so, of course, because we're suspending in 404, because 404 gives an additional remedy. It expands the scope of remedies available to someone who has a non-strictly compliant will, or something that may not even look like a will.
So if my case is weak, I will choose to go under the common law, but if my case is strong, I will choose to go under the statute, is another way of expressing your answer.
You could perceive it that way. I think that if you look at this court's jurisprudence in other settings, you've had cases for inverse condemnation. We've adopted statutes that allow a statutory mode for inverse condemnation, and there's also a pre-existing statute or a pre-existing common law mode to prosecute inverse condemnation. Why the common law test would be favored under a particular set of circumstances is difficult to predict because this area of the law and the judges generally in preserving the court's power, the chancellor's power to do equity and recognize substantial compliance as a common law doctrine.
Well, can I interrupt you there? If probate was historically under English law a matter of equitable jurisprudence.
Yes, Your Honor.
The common law reception statute doesn't apply. The common law reception statute doesn't apply to the ecclesiastical courts of England or the chancery courts of England or the prerogative courts of England.
Yes, Your Honor. And, of course, when the common law, as Your Honor has noted before, when the common law was adopted here in the Americas, that common law changed. Part of the substantial...
My point is there is no such thing as the common law of equitable jurisprudence. That's a contradiction in terms.
But there's a common law on the substantial compliance doctrine is a doctrine of construction that arose in the context of common law judges recognizing that there are statutes. Our statutes coexist with judicial decisions, and those judicial decisions engraft doctrines like the substantial compliance doctrine on these statutes. And this court has done so for 160 years, as early as the
Sturdivant
case.
I think most of the questions that you're answering presuppose that substantial compliance is not specifically overruled in 404 by any text in the statute.
Yes.
So it's a reasonable assumption there was no intent to do that. But the only thing we're debating is the one-year statutory limitation period. And obviously common law had nothing to do with that. There's no supplanting of that at all. It's just a procedural limitation.
I think when you look, Your Honor, at the rationale for not supplanting the common law test or the substantial compliance doctrine with this one-year statute, there is a good reason why you would not graft a one-year statute of limitations on a strictly or substantially compliant rule. Wills can be located and found more than 1 year after the testator's death. That occurred in the Savage case that we've cited. That case, Ms. Savage died in 1883. The will was admitted to probate in 1902.
Actually, when you were opening your answer to that, I was thinking the opposite, which is if we're going to sit around in a courtroom and talk about whether the back of a napkin is a will, that better be brought up pretty close after the guy's
death.
Yes,
Your Honor.
We don't want to be dealing with this 2 years later when people have a lot of time to figure out how to come up with something like that.
And that's right. And that's why when the legislature expanded the statute 404 as broadly as it did, it put a price tag on that expansion. It said if you're going to have a cocktail napkin with a signature, which we won't dispense that requirement, if you're going to have a cocktail napkin, you had better bring it within a year.
The opening says was not executed in compliance with 64.2403. It doesn't say with the exception of documents that may be deemed substantially compliant. It seems that you are perhaps reading language into this that's not there. It was not executed in compliance. It wasn't substantially compliant. It was wildly incompliant. For whatever reason, it is not in compliance.
Yes, but Justice Powell, we're saying that this will, when a third party obstructs and intervenes and interferes with the completion of the will signing, the safeguards for the statute of wills, 403, do exist. There's no middle ground. There's a section 403, and then there's 404. And when you have a substantially compliant will,
it's not compliant. When it is not compliant,
this court's jurisprudence would say it is. If the will complies for substantial compliance, so for example, Your Honor, if the will involves...
Well, if it was compliant, we would not need to... If it was fully compliant, we would never need to consider whether it's substantially
That's
compliant.
That's true, Your Honor, but when you have considered whether it's substantially compliant, it then complies with Code Section 403. A substantially compliant will is not strictly compliant, but it is substantially compliant and qualifies under Rule 4 under Code Section 403. So just very briefly on the issue of the case law, Robinson.
Does the record reflect why your client filed after 15 months rather than prior to 12 months?
Your Honor, I believe the record does reflect that at page 203 in the appendix and page 95 in the appendix. There was a delay in probate. The delay in probate reflected the belief that there were no probatable assets. And it was only because standing was then subsequently challenged in D.C. litigation that more than 1 year after the testator's death that the issue of probating the will arose, Your Honor. And I think I've reserved the balance of my time.
You have 1 minute and 45 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Boland of Reese Broom and Tyson, Virginia. I represent the appellee. James Hash, the son of the decedent Thomas Hash. The discussion that has gone before me is, I think, right on target. However, I think there's an element that is missing from the discussion, and that is precisely, well, there's two elements that are missing from the discussion. One, Mr. Shansov has substantially misdescribed the doctrine of substantial compliance. The doctrine of substantial compliance under the statute of wills only applies in a situation to, in fact, allow this court or any court to find that there was compliance, in fact, with one of the enumerated requirements of the statute. There has never been any case whatsoever where a court has allowed, under the doctrine of substantial compliance, a finding that a proposed testamentary document is a valid will to excuse one of the specific requirements of the code. And in fact...
Right, so you have to sign, but suppose you sign in the margin, or you sign on the back. But there's a signature.
Correct.
And so we have non-compliance, and if we were to strictly construe the statute, it's not a signature isn't where it's supposed to be, but we have a signature. Or we have a second witness, but he didn't see everything that happened because maybe he was in an adjoining room. Here we have no second witness at all. So substantial compliance becomes non-compliance, it seems to me.
Well, that's precisely the point. In fact, the cases of substantial compliance, like you're describing here, is the Robinson versus Ward, the Draper versus Pauley, the cases where the scrivener of these handwritten wills were, in fact, one of the beneficiaries. And there was one other witness in each case, and the issue for the court was whether or not the signature of the scrivener, where they wrote their own name as a beneficiary of the will, was to be counted as a subscribing witness to the will. This court found in both of those cases that was precisely the case. They would count that handwritten signature of the scrivener, who was also the beneficiary, as a witness to the will, and found that the will was substantially complied.
Let me offer another hypothetical. I don't want to cheat you out of And in this one, you've got similar facts. You have a testator in the hospital. You have two witnesses there. The testator signs. Witness number one signs. And at that moment, there is a lightning strike. The testator dies before the second witness has signed. Although the second witness did, in fact, witness the testator signing the will and saying, "This is my last will and testament." Is substantial compliance present?
Well, I would say that it was not. And because there is no... The statute of wills, it's a dual requirement.
Now, under that hypothetical, and this is not your case, under that hypothetical, that would be a harsh result, would it not?
It potentially would be a harsh result.
And the substantial compliance doctrine was put into place in order to avoid harsh results of that nature, was it not?
It was. Let me take another hypothetical here, Your Honor. Taking that same kind of a situation, in fact, take precisely the situation we have in this case, except for this fact. Just before Mr. Hash himself, the testator, signed, there was such an event. He had a heart attack and died. Or he had a heart attack and a stroke and was totally incapacitated, and he didn't sign. But everything else was identical. All the declarations of intention that they rely upon so heavily, everything else was the same. Under their theory of this substantial compliance, that too would be a valid will, where in fact you do not have the signature of the testator. Now, 64.2.4.
I acknowledge that is certainly a close hypothetical, but the testator is allowed to change his testamentary intent up until the moment that the will is completed. So would your argument under that hypothetical be that prior to the signature by the second witness, the testator is capable of saying, wait, I've changed my mind? Is that why that would not substantially comply?
Well, certainly.
Is that the distinction between the hypothetical that I've offered and the one that you have offered in response?
Well, I suppose that is certainly a partial distinction. But the primary reason is the language of the statute itself, which requires two elements. They have to be present at the time that the testator executes the document, and who subscribe in the presence of the testator. In the absence of the subscription, the total absence of the subscription is the fatal flaw to the situation.
No matter what the reason was, whether it was a witness walking out,
that has been the historical standard by which this court has interpreted the statute of wills throughout its entire history. It's an objective standard. You either meet the requirements of the statute or you don't. Under certain circumstances where there is the unusual element of the signature in a different place, this court has found that, in fact, that is a sufficient factual predicate upon which you can find that, in fact, there was been compliance with the statute. But there's never, ever been a situation where a missing element has been excused.
His argument, your opposing counsel's argument, seems to be that in the typical or our prior cases where there was substantial compliance, arguably all of the elements of the statute were met within the document. They may have been in crazy places, signature on a page, a blank page, or something like that, but all of the elements were there. And so as I understand counsel's argument, the lower standard of proof and the element of substantial compliance could allow a court to adjudicate that after a year because everything that you need without any real prejudice to the parties is there within the document. His argument is that this 404 statute is different because it allows the wildly non-compliant document, the back of the napkin, the missing signature. And there you're attempting to protect the testator's intent, avoid prejudice to the other party by limiting the amount of time that you can bring the wildly uncompliant. Why doesn't that make sense?
Well, I don't think that's what 64.2404 was meant to deal with, the wildly. Perhaps it meant to deal with some of the wildly, but it also meant to do with the unusual situations that just didn't get executed properly. In fact, when you look at the language of 404, it is defined in terms of 403. And it is precisely that a document is covered under 404 if it was not executed in compliance with 403. And so you have a situation where you have a document, and you look at 403 and 404. Either it was executed in compliance with 403, or it was not. If it was not, it's covered by 404. And 404 is the rise and fall of that document, which is the case here. Under 403, if it was executed in compliance with it, we never get to 404. So what...
Can I interrupt you there for a second?
Yes.
So if that logic is true, and 404 governs anything that is out of compliance with 403, and clearly it's out of compliance with 403, because 403 requires two witnesses, and they don't have two witnesses, do we need to even address the nuanced boundary lines between substantial and insubstantial compliance? The conclusion would be rather, well, if it's not in compliance, whether substantial, insubstantial, non-compliance, or whatever, we don't need to go into the gradations because it has to be filed within a year.
I believe that's precisely what this court should do. It really boils down to a very simple issue of statutory interpretation. And it either applies to one or the other. Where there's not compliance, then 404 clearly applies. And
because if that weren't true, then we would have to say that 404 applies to non-compliance that wouldn't fit within substantiality, but would apply to compliance that would fit in substantiality. And as you can tell from all of our questions and these lawyers, no one knows where to draw that line.
And the fact of this discussion demonstrates precisely the havoc that it would adopting the rule that Ms. Pomar advocates would do to the law rules in Virginia.
I don't see any havoc that it would create. What are you talking about? What's the havoc?
The havoc would be that if someone allows, as for strategic reasons, as Ms. Pomar did, to not proceed under 404 within the one-year period, to then 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 10, 20 years down the road, come up with this theory that under substantial compliance, I can have this testamentary document admitted to probate. There will never be finality in
how is that any different from having a compliant will that's brought up 20 years later?
A compliant will is no problem because then it has to comply with the statute. A compliant will is one that in fact complies with all the elements, not one that's missing one of the elements.
But I think, honestly, Justice Powell hit it right on the head when she was talking about the fact that with a substantially compliant will, everything is already there. You're not bringing anything in that's not in the document itself. So it's no different than a compliant will, other than there's something that wasn't exactly done right. It's there, it's in the document somewhere, but maybe it's not in the right place, etc.
Well,
so how does that create any more havoc than just allowing a compliant will later?
Because we're talking about wills that are deficient, that are missing an element, as with this one. You can't have...
It's not missing an element. Maybe that's where... Because I thought you said before in your analysis of substantial compliance is that it doesn't apply if an element is missing. If an element is missing, you're not going to fit under the substantial compliance doctrine. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And so that's not what we have here. We have a situation where...
Well, that's different. You're kind of mixing an apple with an orange now. You know, you get into our specific situation, whereas before you were talking about substantial compliance in a abstract sense. I'm sorry.
Well, again, what's interesting about this whole argument, in fact, is that Ms. Pomar We are talking about statutes, and she made no effort to address the language of the statute itself. I mean, the language of the statute of wills is clear. A will not wholly in handwriting is not valid unless all those elements are required. And the 404 is clear that it was a document that was not executed under 403 applies to 404, and I believe that is the answer to the question.
The part that troubles me about this case is, you know, when it's one thing if you have attorneys who are inept or negligent and they don't follow the statutes, but here you have the claim is there's third-party interference. So they're ready to go. They're ready to comply. That second witness is right there. And we don't question the good faith of the hospital. They're concerned about this individual who's ill. But the fact is, I mean, they're ready to go, and a third party comes in, and that's the reason, at least that's what they allege, that they couldn't, in fact, comply with the statute when they're ready to comply. Why wouldn't that be a narrow rule that wouldn't sow havoc to say, hey, they're ready to comply, but due to third-party interference, they couldn't? And then that...
Well, first, it's important the fact that the third party was not my client. It was not the intestate heir of the decedent's estate. And secondly, the third party was a party who was acting, I think, clearly not only in good faith, but was under a duty to protect their patient. It's very clear that, in fact, the motion to admit the probate acknowledges in paragraph 17... The Virginia Hospital Center staff had reason to question Jim Hash's capacity to execute legal documents. This was not just a question, oh, this guy's sick. She acknowledges they had reason to question his capacity to execute any legal
documents. But really, do we get into any of this? Because they have a one-year window to make the argument.
Well, precisely.
So, I mean, if it were substantially compliant, in fact, because lightning strikes or someone has a stroke or some nurse... acts as an ombudsman, what difference does it make? You make your argument, you got a year to make it.
The legislature has provided that remedy, and it's there to take or to reject. It's clear that Ms. Pomar rejected it for her own strategic reasons, and she now should be left with the result of her decision, and it's not to change the law of Virginia. If there are no other questions, I'm completed.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Do you have some time for rebuttal?
Just at the beginning, assuming arguendo, there is no statute of limitations which prevents your doctrine of substantial compliance argument, wouldn't we have to expand the doctrine for this fact scenario to even fit within it?
No, Your Honor, you wouldn't. We think that the third-party interference is very important, and that would be a case of first impression. If that's perceived as an expansion, it would be, but it is a case of first impression regarding the third-party interference. Let me address.
But the issue is really not why the signature wasn't there. The issue is you require a witness signature, you require two witness signatures, and you only have one. Now, the issue is not why it's not there in my mind.
And Justice Powell, we asked this court, Justice Powell, in answer to the points that you and Justice McCullough and Justice Goodwin have brought up, we asked the court to reverse this trial. The trial court didn't believe that the substantial compliance doctrine under this court's jurisprudence existed any longer. Had it done so, it might have noticed that next to the testator's signatures, there's an X. Now, that is not an intended signature by one of the lawyers, and we didn't argue that it's an intended signature. But if all the court is looking for is another mark made contemporaneously to the time, at the time that the testator signed this will, there are two X's made by one of the lawyers. We ask the court to reverse.
Two X's made by one of the lawyers. So
yes,
even if we assume that is a signature, we would have to further assume that it's the signature of the lawyer or of the paralegal or the other person who did not sign.
If I may answer the question, my time is out.
Of course.
I think the trial court should determine it. You can tell the trial court, look at it under substantial compliance and make a determination.
Mr. Chief Justice, this isn't a question, but actually, if there are any third-year law students in the courtroom, no matter what our decision is, this case will be on the bar exam. I just want to make sure.
Thank you.
And with that prediction, the court is adjourned.